I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, saying, "Come and see."
Noise of Thunder Radio with Christian J. Pinto.
Okay, praise the Lord, you guys, and welcome. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today on the show, we are going to talk about Thomas Jefferson and Islam. Thomas Jefferson and Islam. Why? Because there's a series of articles out there. One of them was posted on our Facebook page where, you know, I've been doing a series here on Islam because of, well, it's getting so much attention in the news. And now we've got these statements from Donald Trump saying that we should ban Muslims from coming into the country until the government can figure out what's going on. That's a whole controversial issue. Of course, we did a show talking about this and how, no, it is not unconstitutional what Donald Trump is suggesting. Of course, a lot of that depends on whether or not you believe in the ACLU's leftist post-1960s Constitution, that version of the Constitution, which is really not the Constitution, or the one that existed all the way up until the end of World War II and then into the 1950s. But nevertheless, somebody posted an article. In fact, this was Joe Dickens posted an article about, quote, "the fascinating history of how Jefferson and other founding fathers defended Muslim rights." Defended Muslim rights. And so Joe says, quote, "Hi, Chris. Maybe you can pinpoint the twisting of truth in this article. Something in the telling of this story doesn't sound correct." Well, Joe, you are absolutely right, brother. It is not really correct. It's actually very misleading, in my opinion. First thing I would say right off the bat, when you're hearing about the founders and Muslims and Islam and this kind of thing, it's important to remember that they lived at a time where they did not have the internet, and they didn't really know about the religion of Islam. They knew some things about it. But they were also being influenced by Freemasonry. And Freemasonry, yes, at that time, despite what some have said, Freemasonry did promote a kind of universal theology of all religions. Okay? And so they had that going back centuries, back hundreds of years. Some even believe that you could trace the universal theology of Freemasonry all the way back to the Knights Templar and the Crusades. And part of the reason I say that is because of Rosslyn Chapel. Rosslyn Chapel in Scotland is kind of an ecumenical chapel, intended to be a chapel to St. Matthew, but you go there, and we actually went there, and we show you original footage in Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, Volume 1, The New Atlantis. We end up at Rosslyn Chapel. And you see, you've got Christian iconography there, but then you've also got pagan iconography mingled in. And so this goes back even hundreds of years before the American Revolution. So that doctrine, unfortunately, has been part of Masonry. There are theories about how it got there. I am inclined to believe the theory that says the Knights Templar brought it back from the Crusades, and then it was interwoven into Masonic philosophy. That's generally my impression of it. But of course, there's, you know, you've got all kinds of different historic data out there. But where Islam is concerned, Thomas Jefferson and the founders, I contend, did not really understand the religion of Islam, much like many people in America today don't really understand the religion of Islam. There's an article out there, a young girl who's holding up a sign, and on the sign it says, "I'm a Christian," she says, quote, "I'm a Christian and I love the Quran," end quote. That's what she's saying. I am inclined to think either she is a Christian who is ignorant of what the Quran really teaches and what Sharia law is all about, Either that or she's not really a Christian. But if she knew that under Sharia law, Muslim men have the right to rape non-Muslim women, and historically they've targeted Christian women, something tells me she would change her view of the Quran and of the Islamic religion. Right now, what's happening is a lot of people are parroting off information based upon what they're being told in schools and universities and in the media. And there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of false information being given out in an attempt to be politically correct and make sure you don't offend the Muslims. And over in England, Christians are being prosecuted if they publicly speak against Islam. And it's very important that we wake up to this here in this country and recognize what's happening. There's a story about a here just a couple of days ago in New York. This is from thefreerepublic.com. The headline, New York, quote, black Muslim woman takes oath as judge swears on Holy Quran. New York Judge Carolyn Walker Diallo, a black Muslim woman, took oath as a civil court judge in New York on Thursday while swearing to abide by the U.S. Constitution, placing her hand on the Holy Quran. Now, until recently, anybody sworn into office had to put their hand upon a Bible. Now they are allowing Muslims to be sworn in on the Quran. Of course, because this is dealing with Islam in particular, and because of Sharia, and because Sharia is such an oppressive system that does not measure out equality to all people. It gives rights to Muslims, but the kafir, the infidel, is not equal to a Muslim under Sharia law. So there are rights that apply to Muslims that do not apply to non-Muslims. And I believe it's very, very dangerous for us to allow Muslims to become lawyers and judges and politicians in our system, because that right now they will openly tell you, most Muslims in the country, better than 50%, will say that they believe in Sharia law and they believe Sharia law is higher than our Constitution or anything else, and that Muslims in our country should be governed by Sharia law. And because of their doctrine of taqiyya, the doctrine of being able to lie in different ways and different circumstances, a Muslim judge or a lawyer or a district attorney or a police captain or something could theoretically lie from whatever position of authority they are in. They could lie so that they can promote principles of Sharia while pretending that they're upholding the Constitution. That's the danger of having Muslims come into the country and giving them access to power and authority in the United States. It's a very, very dangerous thing. Very, very dangerous, in my opinion. So, but let's go back to this. Let's go back to this article here on Jefferson and supposedly the headline again, quote, the fascinating history of how Jefferson and other founding fathers defended Muslim rights. Here's what the article says, quote, Muslims are at the center of today's roiling debate over religious freedom in the United States, but they've actually been a part of that heated conversation from the very beginning of the nation's founding. A number of the founding fathers explicitly mentioned Muslims along with other believers outside the prevailing Protestant mainstream as they outlined the parameters of religious freedom and equal protection. Muslims, referred to in those years as Mahometans or alluded to as Turks, likely lived in this country. An estimated 20% of enslaved Africans were Muslim. But much of the citizenry at the time didn't acknowledge that Muslims existed in America, according to several historians. All right. Then it goes on, it says, unlike Jews and Catholics, Muslims were discussed in the hypothetical and often with negative opinions, including those held by Thomas Jefferson, to show how far tolerance and equal civil rights extends. Then it goes on from there. This estimated 20% of enslaved Africans, you've got, I've seen other estimates that place it up at 30%. I mean, this isn't, it's certainly possible, but they don't really have any way of documenting it. They don't have any way of proving it. There's another article on Patheos.com That's a response to the comment by President Barack Obama about how Muslims were woven into the fabric of the country. An article by Thomas Kidd, and he quotes from the book Faith and the Founders of the American Republic, and says, according to that book, says there were actual Muslims living in America during the founding period, but the vast majority of them were toiling as slaves in the South. It goes on, quote, the exact number of Muslims, of course, is hard to discern, but historian Michael Gomez has estimated that perhaps 200,000 slaves came from African regions. So that is one of the estimates. But again, it's an estimate. It's not anything they have any way of proving. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to say that, well, Islam has been a part of America from the beginning. That's the argument. And that would be, I mean, go to Saudi Arabia and tell the Muslims that the Jews have a 1,400-year history in the city of Medina, and that in ancient Medina, there were Jews there. Yeah, well, maybe there were, but you know what? They killed them, enslaved them, or drove them out. The Jews aren't going to be able to go to Medina and claim that the Muslims need to give them part of Medina, or that they need to acknowledge Jewish people in Medina or something. I mean, we could go to Constantinople today, which today is modern-day Istanbul, the capital of Turkey, and talk about the thousand-year history of Christianity in Istanbul that Christians founded, built, developed, and sustained Constantinople for 1,000 years before it was invaded in 1453 by the Turks. Do you think the Muslims there are going to give some kind of special consideration to the Christians? You think they're going to give special political power to the Christians in Istanbul today? No. Christians are routinely mistreated in Turkey, at least from the reports that I've read. So the Jews aren't going to get special favors in Medina, and the Christians aren't going to get any special favors in Istanbul, in spite of the fact that Christianity and Judaism have centuries-old histories in those parts of the world. The Christians in Iraq today that have been there since the first century, going all the way back to the very beginning of Christianity, the Muslims don't care how long the Christians have been in that part of the world. They've been there 2,000 years. The Muslims could care less. They're killing them, imprisoning them, enslaving them, driving them out, crucifying them, beheading them. And yet we're supposed to be concerned that there were some Muslims in early America, as if that means that Islam played any significant role in the establishment of the United States, which it really didn't. I mean, there's just no evidence of that. And Islam, we know, would never have developed something like the U.S. Constitution. There is no Islamic country anywhere in the world or anywhere in history that has ever operated like America or would ever operate like America. They don't hold those same beliefs. In fact, I think it was an episode of Hannity where Sean Hannity was interviewing several Muslim teachers and asked if there was any Muslim country in the world that defended the rights of women, just the rights of women, in the same way or at an equal level with America, the United States. And of course, he couldn't think of even one because there isn't one. So it's quite a bit of a leap to say that Jefferson was defending Muslim rights. If you read this article to its end, it goes on. It says here toward the end, it says, quote, in 1765, while he was studying law, Jefferson purchased an English translation of the Quran. He later went on to criticize the religion as anti-science and anti-reason, which it is. Islam always suppressed scientific advancement. It's why their countries have to borrow technology from other countries, typically Western countries. It goes on, it says, from there, despite his personal opinions, however, Jefferson staunchly defended the right of Americans to hold any religious belief, no matter how absurd or wrong they seemed to him. Quote, the legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others, Jefferson wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia, his only book. Quote, but it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg," end quote. So Jefferson's view was, from that quote, in terms of extending tolerance to other belief systems, it's exactly the same view that I have quoted on the program many times before from Samuel Adams in his Rights of the Colonists, 1772, where he's talking about John Locke and the leading Christian thinkers in the world at that time, and how their view, their belief was that tolerance should be extended to all whose beliefs are neither hostile nor subversive to the powers of the state or of society. In other words, if somebody's part of a belief system, just as Jefferson is saying, if they believe there are 20 gods or they believe there's one god or whatever, as long as they're not harming anyone, as long as what they're doing and what they believe does not lead to the harm of their fellow citizens, then it's not something we should object to. And I think most Americans and most Christians in America generally believe that. Now, we're coming up on a commercial break. We're going to go to a commercial break, and then I am going to highlight other aspects of this article where they talk about James Madison and they talk about putting a stop, because Madison and Jefferson both agreed that the common people should not be expected to pay a tax to sustain the church, to sustain churches, that the government should not force the people to pay a tax for that. And there's a whole debate that happened as a result. But we're going to talk about some of the details of that debate and what James Madison actually wrote about. And it is quite the opposite of what groups like the ACLU and even the people who wrote this article, it's the exact opposite of what they're telling us. And what we're going to see is something that I have become more and more suspicious of, and that is that the Christian worldview where tolerance is concerned is that tolerance should be given to those who are of other belief systems as long as they're not hostile or subversive. Why? So that they will have an opportunity to hear the gospel preached in a Christian society. And we're going to talk about that, and I'm going to read you the quotes from James Madison when we come back right after this.
Adullam Films presents Dark Clouds Over Elberton, the true story of the Georgia Guidestones, a dynamic new documentary exposing the environmental agenda. In 1980, this granite monument was erected by an anonymous stranger who called himself R.C. Christian. He claimed to represent a small group that wished to usher in the Age of Reason. Sometimes called the American Stonehenge, this strange monument is said to contain the Ten Commandments of the New Age, or the Ten Commandments of the Antichrist. It calls for global government, environmental control, and worst of all, it says to maintain the world population under 500 million people. But who was R.C. Christian, and does his monument have something to do with the climate change agenda of the United Nations today? Find out by ordering Dark Clouds Over Elberton, the true story of the Georgia Guidestones. Available at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
Tool for church and Bible study groups around the world. noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
If you want to understand the times through the lens of a biblical worldview, get answers to important Bible questions, or be involved in intensive Bible study and research, then check out situationroom.net/join. You can now join for just $7.99 a month and have instant access to the radio and television programs of Brannon House, Mike Gendron, Mike Abendroth, Mike Riddle, Justin Peters, John Whitcomb, Jimmy DeYoung, Jesse Johnson, Susan Heck, Chris Pinto, John Leffler, T.A. McMahon, Michael John Beasley, David Farnell, and Tommy Ice. Many of these programs are exclusive to the Situation Room and are produced and or distributed by Worldview Weekend from our radio and television studios in Memphis, Tennessee. Our goal is to help you defend and proclaim a biblical worldview. So why not go to situationroom.net/join right now and look at what is waiting for you as a member. This is broadcast quality, biblically sound, on-demand content for the entire family. Situationroom.net/join. Join now, and we'll send you 20 Worldview Weekend DVDs as our way of saying thank you for becoming a member or for renewing your membership. That's $300 in free DVDs shipped to you free of charge when you join at situationroom.net/join.
Okay, we are back. Praise the Lord, you guys. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today in the show, we are talking about Thomas Jefferson, the founders, and Islam. Was Jefferson and were the founders trying to defend the rights of Muslims? Did they go out of their way to defend the rights of Muslims? Well, we are going to talk more about that here shortly. But before we do, I did want to say to people who are listening to the program, if you are listening to our show through Worldview Weekend, we know a lot of you listen through Worldview Weekend with Brannon House, but we want you to know we do have our own website at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com. You can go to our main website there, and you can not only listen to this show directly, but then we have a whole host of other shows in the archives that you can listen to, dealing with a whole variety of subjects. Now, here for the last week or two, I've been talking about Islam and all of these issues on immigration and the flood of immigrants coming from Syria and so on. And what are the implications of this? What is this going to mean? Or what does this mean right now in Europe? And what will it mean here in the United States as this problem is progressing more and more? And this is, there's no question, this issue is on the American main stage for the 2016 upcoming election. We've got the debate. The next Republican debate happens Tuesday on CNN. This should be very, very interesting to see what happens. Donald Trump made his controversial comments about banning all Muslims from coming into the country, and his numbers have skyrocketed. They've gone up. Now they're trying to say that Ted Cruz is ahead in Iowa. That could well be the case, but I am inclined to wait a couple of days and see what happens with those numbers. The media keeps looking for a way to argue that Trump is losing or that he's going to lose or something. All right, but before we go on with this, I wanted to draw attention to something. On our Facebook page, under the show, Trump and the Ban on Muslims, one of our listeners named Vato Taft, who left us a nice compliment on there. He said the program has been stellar lately. Very nice comment. But what I really wanted to highlight is the fact that Vato Taft has as his Facebook profile picture a black and white photo of an old, authentic G.I. Joe. The old authentic G.I. Joe, and he's actually got a couple of photos of the old bearded G.I. Joe, the guy with the scar and the realistic looking hair. And I have to tell you, Vato, I have to tell you, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, when I was a kid, I absolutely loved the old G.I. Joes. Absolutely loved them. my favorite toy anywhere that I had when I was a kid. I had a number of them. I had the sailor guy with the orange raft, the Navy guy, the Army guy. The original G.I. Joes were probably the greatest toys that was ever made for boys. Just an amazing, amazing toy. Lots of fun. All right. I brought back memories. Brought back many memories being a kid. Okay. Back to the fascinating history of how Jefferson and other founding fathers allegedly defended Muslim rights. Now it's really, really misleading. Really, really misleading within the context that it's being presented. And I'll explain to you why. Okay, so it goes on here, and it's quoting from Jefferson's opinion on religious liberty were heavily influenced by John Locke. That is true. As noted by James H. Hudson, writing in 2002 as chief of the Library of Congress's Manuscript Division, he says, quote, in his seminal letter on toleration, 1689, John Locke insisted that Muslims and all others who believed in God be tolerated in England. Campaigning for religious freedom in Virginia, Jefferson followed Locke, his idol, in demanding recognition of the religious rights of the Mohammedan, the Jew, and the pagan. Supporting Jefferson was his old ally, Richard Henry Lee, who had made a motion in Congress on June 7, 1776, that the American colonies declare independence. True freedom, Lee asserted, embraces the Mohammedan and the Gentoo or the Hindu, as well as the Christian religion. Now, he says that in a private letter. In a private letter. Goes on, and it says, quote, James Madison, whose views on religious liberty aligned with Jefferson's, helped usher the Virginia Bill to final passage. In a document arguing against religious taxes that received thousands of signatures, Madison referenced foreign religious persecution, specifically the Inquisition. He also argued that separation of church and state would actually promote Christianity. Notice this. Notice that. Madison argued that separation of church and state would actually promote Christianity. Would promote Christianity, writing that an open society would be welcoming to those, quote, this is important, brethren, an open society would be welcoming to those who were, quote, remaining under the dominion of false religions, end quote. Those are the words of James Madison. Notice that James Madison acknowledges that non-Christian religions are false religions. He does not believe that they are equal to Christianity. And that is key. Tolerance is one thing. Empowerment is something else. And this takes us back to the original meaning of the First Amendment, brethren. This is why the comment of Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, when Joseph Story says that the purpose of the First Amendment was not to make Christianity equal to Mohammedism or Hinduism or infidelity, but only to prevent any Christian denomination from seizing control of the national government. Now, don't take my word for that, brethren. Go and look up Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story. You read his words. Because if what the ACLU and these leftist groups are telling us today is true, much of everything that happened prior to the 1960s, you would have to argue that the founders themselves did not understand the Constitution and that nobody understood the Constitution until after the 1960s when they implemented these new ideas. It's completely ridiculous. So he says, it goes on, it says, quote, establishing an official church, he wrote, discourages those who are strangers to the light of revelation. Now, what did Madison mean? Because he's quoting James Madison there. What did Madison mean? Well, to figure that out, you have to go and look up the document arguing against religious taxes, because that was the whole issue. And he and Jefferson were in common. They had this in common. They did not believe that there should be a tax charged, that people shouldn't be forced to pay a tax to support the state. And one of Madison's arguments was that this was actually, it would hinder Christianity. Okay? That it would hinder Christianity. And the purpose of Christianity, which is what? To preach the gospel. That was the purpose of Christianity. Now, here is what Madison says, and you can find this on the University of Chicago website at uchicago.edu. And this is James Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments from 1785. And he's speaking against the idea of collecting a religious tax for the church because he says, and he gives a list of 15 reasons why. You go down and you read number 12. Number 12. The 12th reason why collecting a tax from all citizens for the church, for Christianity, for the Christian church, really for a state church, why it's a bad idea. He said, quote, because the policy of the bill is adverse to the diffusion of the light of Christianity. The policy of the bill is adverse or against the diffusion, that is, the spreading of the light of Christianity. The bill will be against the spread of Christianity. He says, quote, the first wish of those who enjoy this precious gift ought to be that it may be imparted to the whole race of mankind. He goes on, he says, quote, compare the number of those who have as yet received it with the number still remaining under the dominion of false religions. That is, those who have received the light of Christianity versus those who remain under the dominion of false religions. He says, and how small is the former? Meaning, how small are the number of those who have received the gospel, who are Christian people? So he goes on, he says, quote, does the policy of the bill tend to lessen the disproportion? No, it at once discourages those who are strangers to the light of revelation from coming into the region of it. In other words, the region, that part of the world, wherein the revelation of Christianity dwells. It discourages strangers from coming into a Christian country by having a law like this. Discourages them from coming into the region of it and countenances by example the nations who continue in darkness in shutting out those who might convey it to them. Instead of leveling as far as possible every obstacle to the victorious progress of truth, the bill, with an ignoble and unchristian timidity, would circumscribe it with a wall of defense against the encroachments of error. All right, so he seems to be saying, based upon that, that the bill, the way it's written, is actually going to hinder the progress of Christianity in the country. And it's adverse to the diffusion or the spread of the light of Christianity. Now, what's interesting is, and this is one of those historic quotes that seems to support the idea that when the founders talked about religion in the context, they meant Christianity in a favorable context. The other religions, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc., were always seen as false religions, at least in public, in private letters that some founders who may have been Freemasons or had that association, their private letters are one thing. Their public statements, things that they're declaring. And now this is a document, an historic document being written here by James Madison. This is a matter of public record. And this is an argument being made about why having funding for a state church, basically, is not a good idea. because it empowers a state church system, then of course you're going to have to say, okay, well, what denomination of Christianity? When they were talking about religion, when they talked about religion, religion publicly is almost always in the context of Christianity, meaning we're talking about variant forms of Christianity, various denominations of Christianity. Pagan religions, Islam, Hinduism, and the others, these are seen as false religions. And this is, notice, Madison is very clearly saying that. He's calling them strangers. He's talking about those who have yet received the light of Christianity, with the number still remaining under the dominion of false religions. You have the comment here. I read this some time ago from the U.S. Supreme Court, February 29th, 1892, in the case of Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States, Justice Josiah Brewer, in rendering the High Court's decision, he goes on, well, it's a big long explanation, but he says this, he says, quote, "The people of this state, in common with the people of this country, profess the general doctrines of Christianity as the rule of their faith and practice. We are a Christian people, and the morality of the country is deeply engulfed upon Christianity, and not upon the doctrines or worship of those impostors." Impostors meaning impostor religions. That's the idea, impostor religions. So the other religions have always been seen in terms of the official view of American law, or at least they were through the 19th century, seen as impostors, seen as false religions, not seen as being counted equal to Christianity. Now, I personally believe, brethren, you know, when we're sitting here watching what's going on with having a Muslim sworn in as a judge, when they're bringing a Wiccan priestess to go and pray in a court somewhere, when they brought the atheist into the to another court and he's praying, if I remember correctly, he prayed in the name of Thor and Satan and Muhammad and Jesus and Buddha and so on, all from an atheist perspective, as though the whole thing just didn't matter. And then, of course, now having the satanic monument erected, or the Church of Satan trying to erect a satanic monument across from a monument dedicated to the Ten Commandments. If we believe the ACLU's interpretation of the Constitution, those things are unavoidable. It's almost impossible to say no to other belief systems and to give them an equal place in the country if we believe the ACLU's interpretation of the Constitution. And I believe the only way to stop this flood of paganism and anti-Christian philosophy that really is simply not compatible with Christianity and will always seek to undermine and overthrow Christianity in this country. It's always going to seek to do that. The only way to spare our country from this progress of evil is to restore the original understanding of constitutional law and the original understanding of what the purpose of religious toleration was from the beginning. And I think a case could be made, a very good case could be made from Madison's own words here, that the original purpose of tolerance, one, tolerance is not to be extended to somebody, to any group, whether it's the Muslims or whoever it is, that have a hostile and subversive belief system. That's according to James Madison. That's according to Thomas Jefferson. That's according to Samuel Adams. None of the founders would have agreed with the idea of having people come over here who are planning and plotting to overthrow the country and to undermine constitutional freedom. Nobody would have agreed to that. And that's where I think that article saying that the founders were defending Muslim rights and Jefferson was defending Muslim rights, he never would have defended the idea of people coming over here and planning and plotting against the United States and giving them access to the country, knowing that this is what they're doing. However, it's important to recognize that Jefferson and the other founders had a very limited knowledge of Islam at that point in history. In fact, if you go to, there's an article on thefederalistpapers.org, and the article is titled, Obama Could Learn from Thomas Jefferson's 1801 Response to Muslims During the Barbary Coast War. And this talks about the Barbary War. I mentioned this the other day on the program. It says the First Barbary War was the first of two wars fought between the United States and the Northwest African Berber Muslim states, known collectively as the Barbary States. These were the Ottoman provinces of Tripoli, Algiers, and Tunis, which were enjoying a large autonomy, as well as the independent Sultanate of Morocco. The war was fought because U.S. President Thomas Jefferson refused to pay the high tributes demanded by the Barbary States, and because they were seizing American merchant ships and enslaving the crews for high ransoms. It was the first declared war the United States fought on foreign land and seas. Then it goes on. It says, quote, in 1786, Jefferson and Adams met with Tripoli's ambassador to Great Britain. They asked this diplomat by what right his nation attacked American ships and enslaved her citizens, and why the Muslims held such hostility toward this new nation, with which neither Tripoli nor any of the other Barbary Coast nations had any previous contact. Now, bear that in mind, brethren. The next time we hear on the news anybody who says, well, the Muslims are just angry at America because of some foreign policy. Remember, the first contact that we had with an Islamic state was one of hostility and aggression and attack and enslavement. And there was no political act that America had done. There was nothing. There were no politics. We were a new nation at that point. And so American leaders, Jefferson and Adams here, they're baffled. Why are they so hostile toward us? Why are they attacking us, etc.? So they'd had no previous contact. And the article goes on to say, quote, the answer was quite revealing. Sidi Haji Abdul Rahman Aja, the ambassador, replied that Islam, quote, was founded on the laws of their prophet, that it was written in their Quran that all nations who should not have acknowledged their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war upon them wherever they could be found, and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners, and that every Muslim or Muslim who should be slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. And it goes on, it says, that is indeed quite revealing. Yet America continued paying ransoms to these terrorists for the next 15 years or so until Jefferson became president. Then the Pasha of Tripoli sent a demand to the new leader for an immediate payment of $225,000 and $25,000 per year on an ongoing basis. Jefferson flatly refused, leading the Pasha to cut down the flagpole of the American consulate and declaring war on the United States. Then it goes on. It says, Jefferson had formerly been against raising a navy, but this soon changed as he was determined to meet force with force. A squadron of vessels was sent to the area, and Congress authorized Jefferson to have the U.S. ships seize all vessels and goods that belonged to the Pasha and anything else deemed necessary. As they saw the U.S. was actually committed to the fight, Algiers and Tunis quickly abandoned the war and allegiance to Tripoli. Obviously, the U.S. won the war. This was the reason why the line to the shores of Tripoli was added to the Marine Corps hymn. So this hostility with Islam and terrorism, and this, I mean, acts of terrorism have been part of Islam from the beginning. Not just from the beginning of Islam with Muhammad, but even the beginning of our own dealings with Islam. The way they've dealt with the United States, the first contact that we had. Now, this whole episode, I think, is very significant when talking about this article here on Jefferson and whether or not he was defending the rights of Muslims. Why? Because the things that they were saying about Islam were being said prior to 1786 and the Barbary Wars. To my understanding, it's in 1786 that you have Jefferson and Adams meeting with Tripoli's ambassadors. So the American Revolution has happened, Constitution's ratified, 1785. Then they're puzzled, they're baffled by why these Muslim pirates keep attacking their ships and why this is part of the Ottoman Empire. Why do they feel that they need to do this? Oh, well, it's because of their belief system, because of their religion. Their prophet Muhammad has told them to make perpetual war. In fact, there is a book called The Control Factor, Our Struggle to See the True Threat by Bill Siegel. And he cites excerpts from John Quincy Adams' essays on Islam. And these are a few excerpts from what John Quincy Adams said about Islam. He said, quote, Muhammad declared undistinguishing and exterminating war as part of his religion against all the rest of mankind. The precept of the Quran is perpetual war against all who deny that Muhammad is the prophet of God. The vanquished may purchase their lives by the payment of tribute. As the essential principle of Muhammad's faith is the subjugation of others by the sword, it is only by force that his false doctrines can be dispelled and his power annihilated. That's what John Quincy Adams came to the conclusion of, that because they use the sword, because they use force, the only way you can stop them is by force. Adams also said, quote, the commands of the prophet may be performed alike by fraud or by force. And again, the whole concept of fraud takes us back to taqiyya, the doctrine of lying or deceiving your enemy. So fraud is perfectly acceptable. That's John Quincy Adams' interpretation. All right. So that is my response to this whole issue about whether or not Islam and the rights of Muslims were really in view. I would argue a couple of things. One, I don't think the founders really understood Islam when they were making certain comments. I do not believe that they honestly believed that Sharia law should be equal to or was no better or different or whatever to the law of God in the Bible, that somehow or other they were one and the same thing. I don't think they would agree to that. And we have, I mean, these comments here from John Quincy Adams, comments from Jefferson believing that the Quran is anti-science and so on. It's kind of hard to believe that they were really promoting Islam in that way. But the reality is, what they're doing is they're going through the history and they're finding these references to Muhammadism, which are few and far between. There's very few of them, because if there were any Muslims in the country at that time, they were very, very few. And so Islam at that time was not really an issue. It begins to be an issue during the Barbary War. And right off the bat, there's hostility and opposition. All right, brethren, that is going to do it for us today. That is our show. We'll stop it there. But we will be back next time as the Lord leads us. Until then, God bless you guys. I'm Chris Pinto, and you've been listening to Noise of Thunder Radio.